Okay, so this is part two of the series that Francois and I are giving. And to give you a little bigger picture of where we are, Francois introduced the Boltzmann equation and went on to the Euler equation last time of gas dynamics. What I'd like to do today is sort of couch things in a more general setting, in part to begin to bridge to some of the ideas one needs for plasma physics. I still won't do collisionless plasmas. I will always have collisions. I won't even have any force fields on it. But that is, depending on the nature of the force field, is either not much of an obstacle or a substantial obstacle, but conceptually at least and often can be handled. I will also discuss things that are also related to plasmas that you'll see in this lecture. Then Francois, in the second hour today, will give a discussion of sort of the traditional approaches to fluid dynamics systems, the Hilbert and Chapman-Enskog expansions. And then tomorrow, I will give a relatively formal lecture identifying non-traditional, I would say, fluid dynamic limits that one can have from the expansion. And then the last two lectures tomorrow will put this program on a very concrete analytical footing. And so this will talk finally about rigorous notions of solutions and limits and so on and so forth. And the culmination will be what is Francois's focus on what is so far the crowning jewel in this particular program of getting global fluid dynamic limits for Boltzmann. So basically, I'm going to step into this more general setting first. And I'll give an introduction of the setting and talk about abstract properties of collision operators that generally yield good properties for fluid dynamics, discuss the consequences of those properties, describe very general Euler, compressible Euler systems, and then give examples that fit into this general setting. All right, so the class I'm going to discuss will, of course, include the Boltzmann equation. The purpose of giving a more general class is to show how to apply the concepts that Francois introduced in the first lecture to other settings. Somehow a two got in there that shouldn't be. Okay, so what we're going to do is I'm going to consider gas of identical molecules. Actually, I have a pointer up here, I notice. And I'll consider things in RD. Of course, we all know D is really 3. For some numerical purposes, D is 2. But, you know, it's mathematicians tend to have interest in general D, as do some theoretical physicists. So we won't apologize anymore for that. Now, what's different from before is I'm going to consider the particle described by its position and some local state. This could include not just the velocity of the molecule, but potentially angular rotation, momentum, rotational momentum, things like that. Certain internal degrees of freedom, perhaps their vibrational degrees of freedom. So this will be described, and there's a measure associated with that state space S. So, and to each, there's a function V, which actually gives the velocity of the center of the mass. So I'm going to need that function V as a function of the state of the particle. And what this does is, by allowing this this more freedom here, I can introduce things like internal degrees of freedom and other things that allow an extension of the range of the kinetic theory. Okay, so the kinetic density is a function now of the state, the position, and the time. And just in analog with what Francois did yesterday, if you have a measurable set over the single particle phase space, this represents the number. Oh, sorry, yeah. And the kinetic equation has a form very similar to what we saw last time, just with the understanding that this is now a function of S, and this collision operator acts only on the S variable, just like before. Doesn't act on the x variable at all. And it'll be defined over some domain which is included in L1 d sigma. In fact, it's contained within the cone of non-negative functions, as per your question, or comment, I should say, yesterday. And Let me get that stupid mouse out of there. I always see that little hand of someone crying for help or something. Help me, I'm in the screen. All right, so I'll introduce this bracket notation to mean the integral over the whole state space of d sigma. And now the main point here is the overview of this second part is that there's going to be properties. And these properties have to do, that the collision operator must satisfy, these have to do with first conservation, then dissipation, then equilibria, and dissipation and entropy go together, as you'll see. Yeah, question. Yes, you can think of the velocity is a function of S. So in particular, the velocity could be one of the components of S. And you'll see that in the examples, in fact. So any function of S is said to be locally conserved if it has the property that the integral against the collision operator is zero for every F in the domain of C. Of first course, you first prove this for all sufficiently nice F, but then you go to the whole domain by density. Now, it's clear this is a linear constraint on E, so we have a linear subspace formed by the span of such guys, which we assume is non-trivial and finite dimensional. I didn't say finite dimensional, but I do mean finite dimensional. So in the classic case of the Boltzmann equation, E is just what's spanned by 1, the components of velocity, and mod v square. And so let's say there are n such things, finite dimensional. If I let this bold E, and that E is supposed to look bolder than those, be a column vector whose components are this basis functions, I'll just get a basis function for this space, then I can, in a very compact way, write the local conservation laws, because when I multiply the kinetic equation by the bold E and integrate, the collision term goes away, and I just get this density and this flux term here, and that's what they are called. These express any local conservation laws you have associated with the kinetic equation. I should remark that you think of these as physical objects. However, in when one uses sort of toy kinetic equations for lattice Boltzmann simulations of fluids and stuff like that, you can have very artificial conservation laws that are really designed by hand in order to achieve certain goals. So one shouldn't, while one should think of these as the prime example as being physical conservation laws, they need not be, and in some applications are not. Now, the other important property we need is entropy dissipation. So I have a special function which is called an entropy for the collision operator. It's strictly convex for positive Fs. It satisfies when F is in the domain, I get that the entropy of F is in L1, and also this guy is in L1. This is part of what it means to be in the domain. In particular, if this subscript F means derivative, so the derivative of eta with respect to F times the collision operator, this always has a sign for everything in the domain. And for every F in the domain of C, the following are equivalent. That this is called the dissipation rate. It vanishes identically. That's a scalar condition. It's just the vanishing up here. And that this F is actually in equilibrium, that is a function of S, so that's a function condition, which is actually a value of functions. And similarly, this guy is in the span, is in this E space, which is the span of the components of the bold E vector. And this abstracts Boltzmann's H theorem. In the case of the Boltzmann equation, I think I say it on the next slide, yes I do, that the eta is of course F log F minus F, or that's just a convenient. And then if you have that entropy, multiply the Boltzmann equation by eta prime of F, that is to say log of F in this case, what you get is the traditional entropy dissipation law. This becomes the entropy, this is losing its power maybe. Anyway, this is the entropy density, here's the entropy flux, here's the entropy dissipation rate. So as you can see, we've just abstracted things. Question in the back. I'm going to abuse the word a little bit. I will talk about the eta, which is kind of a function of the kinetic density, and I will call that the entropy. But in fact, what the entropy is, more properly, is the integral of this over S, and this is the entropy as a function of X and T. Okay, so I'll call this the entropy density, just to call it something else. Okay. I should comment, too, that this is the negative of the thermodynamic entropy. This is Boltzmann's version of things. So there's another kind of thing that in this abstraction comes has to be stated, because it comes so freely for the Boltzmann case that you don't even think about it at first as something that you have to state until you run across examples where you realize that it is an extra assumption. And that is that if you we assume a certain existence of an entropy of an equilibria that has the following thing. If you take anything f in the domain of C and you compute its conserved densities, this gives you a bunch of a vector in Rn. And what we're going to assume is that for everything in the domain of C that you compute these numbers, for every such value, there exists a unique equilibrium that has exactly those values. Now, for the Boltzmann equation, you just write this down because you know the local Maxwellia. You can do all the integrals and see it exists. But I'll even give examples where this assumption has to be isn't actually always held. So this is doesn't hold. Examples where this. Really, this assumption separates certain kinetic theories apart. All right, now let me talk about some consequences of the properties. And the first consequence of the property, I'll sort of some notation. So when you see products like this, this is a matrix multiplication. I understand this is a column vector, the E, and the beta I'm understanding is a row vector. I'll indicate the row vectors with Rn star. All right, so for those that want to be precise, I'm hoping I'm precise in my language on the new graph, at least. So the first consequence of these properties is one can actually find a formula for this E as a function of rho. That is to say, we can generalize the Maxwellian formula. And what one understands is this is sort of interesting because the collision operator I've said nothing about except these general properties. And what this means is the form of equilibria has nothing to do with the details of the collision operator except in so much as it has to do with these certain general properties of the collision operators. So this is a fundamental fact. So the characterization 3 in the H theorem kind of discussion was that equilibria satisfy this relationship here. That is to say, the derivative of the entropy with respect to f of f is equal to some linear combination of that something in the span, which means some linear combination of the components of boldface E. Okay, now I can actually explicitly solve this, I can explicitly do it in terms of something called the Legendre transform of eta. And so, since this is a course, I therefore have a slide to explain to those of you that have never seen it what the Legendre transform is. So the Legendre transform is defined for any convex function, and even more generally for not convex functions. I won't discuss that here. You can define it implicitly when z is in the range of the derivative of eta. So that should be yeah, that's right. That's correct. This should have been a subscript y over here. So what you do is you just write down this system of equations. This defines the eta star because this actually is a nice invertible map. Remember that I'm assuming the eta is strictly convex, and as such, this is a one-to-one map, and I can therefore invert it and solve for y as a function of z, and that then gives me eta star of z when I put it in here. Moreover, it's clear from the sort of symmetry in this relationship and the fact that you can, by using implicit differentiation on here, check that this is true, y is the derivative of eta star with respect to z, that the Legendre transform is an involution. The Legendre transform of the Legendre transform goes back to the original function. Perhaps, yeah, question.
You insisted that the number of conserved quantities is finite.
Yes.
That holds out all this past fluid with a continuum, say, of particle masses or what? Or particle sizes.
Say again?
If I'm doing polymer physics, I can
explain. Yes, right.
It's a wide range.
Right.
And
the finiteness assumption actually just makes my discussion a little easier here. One can, if one introduces some technical conditions, extend this to infinite, you know, a continuum range of things, but then you have to worry about what it means for convergence and so forth. So I'll just do this. This is the simplest possible case, and it really includes, yeah, that generalization is useful in that case, but it also brings more technical baggage than I want to deal with here.
Including here.
In particular here. Actually, not just here. All right, so the Legendre duals derivative then gives the inverse of that relationship, and so once, if I could write down the Legendre dual, then indeed I have an explicit formula in terms of these parameters beta. And it's natural to identify a set R star, a bunch of column vectors, that have the property that this guy always gives me something in the domain. And this, and such a thing will automatically be in equilibria, you can see from the characterization of the H-theorem assumed characterization. So this is, the main thing to understand is the family of equilibria depends only on the set of locally, the span of all locally conserved quantities, the choice of entropy, and the domain of C. All right, so what's the classic example? Well, eta is going to be the F log F minus F. It's Legendre dual. I leave it as an exercise. It's just the exponential of Z, and therefore, the equilibria by the formula is just, since the derivative of the exponent is again the exponent, the derivatives are generally, I mean, the equilibria have this form, and E, of course, is identified this way. So now you can see that this form is indeed recovers the local Maxwellian. I recall for you a slightly different notation than Francois used, but here's the local Maxwellia, the equilibria, and that if I identify beta, this vector, in this manner, then indeed you can check that, put it up here with that E, and you recover this. So this falls into the general framework. All right, now comes a very important player in the structure. If you take that Legendre dual of eta and you integrate it, and this, the fact this is integrable follows from the assumptions about things being in the domain of C, then this function, which is going to be, remember, this is a convex function, being the Legendre dual of a convex function, and so this is a convex function of the vector beta. And this convex function, in fact, strictly convex function, is, we call the density potential. Why? Because if you differentiate it with respect to beta, you recover exactly the densities rho. So this is the relationship between these. And it therefore makes somehow this beta variable all of a sudden, which, I mean, the rho's clearly have physical meaning, the conserved densities. The beta seems to be artificial at first, but now through this relationship, you see it's actually intimately tied to the rho's. By the way, the notion of the calling it beta is not, is to recall for you a little bit the use of the beta in the statistical mechanics. This is minus the beta of statistical mechanics, which is only a scalar. I could make that remark on the previous thing. Notice here's the beta. See what that is? That's minus 1 over theta. And that's the beta of statistical mechanics. This is non-equilibrium version of all of that. And so you can think of this vector beta as the non-equilibrium version of the statistical mechanics beta. Okay. So now since H star is a convex function, I can invert it, strictly convex function, I can invert it again with the trick of the Legendre transformation, now where it's a Legendre transformation of a vector-valued object, potentially infinite-dimensional, but finite-dimensional in this case, and so you have this relationship here, and indeed, if you put all this together, you now have a very explicit formula. You see, this is very nice. If you know the entropy, you have its Legendre dual, the derivative of that, then what goes in there is a linear combination of the conserved quantities and then the derivative, or the gradient of this H of rho with respect to rho, conserved densities. So another consequence of these properties is that you can understand this H of rho very simply with a little bit of work, which I won't drag you through. But this H of rho is nothing but eta evaluated at this equilibrium. So in other words, this is the kinetic equilibrium restricted to the manifold of local equilibrium. And this will be the entropy associated with the Euler equations in general. You can also show that this guy is characterized as the minimum, you can characterize it by minimizing this entropy here over anything in the domain that satisfies the constraints here. All right, now let's talk about the compressible Euler systems. So as Francois indicated last time, you put a 1 over epsilon here, and what I'm doing is I'm setting this Joule number to 1, the Knudsen number to epsilon, thus giving me this form of the equation. And I argue, therefore, that F to leading order has to be in local equilibrium. That is to say, it has to be this any version of the equilibrium family. Now, let me use the beta representation first, because the beta representation has certain nice features, as you'll see on the next slide. So if you just assume that the F has the form here where the beta you now depends parametrically on X and T, then these conservation laws govern the evolution of beta. So if you understand this, here's the beta here. This is beta as a function of X and T. This E only depends on V, on S, I mean. And this whole thing is integrated over the S variable, the states. And so this thing here is just algebraically depends on the beta, which are functions of X and T, similarly here. So you, in principle, if you can do the integrals indicated by those brackets, you have explicit formulas. If not, and for most equations of states, in fact, except for the simplest ones, you can't do these integrals analytically, you go ahead and numerically approximate them with quadrature here. And that's something that people do indeed. So now the Euler system can be recast in terms of this density potential that I introduced before. I recall the definition here, and something I'll call the flux potential. And again, the reason for these names is that, oops, that should have been a subscript beta that somehow became a, all right. This is what's written correctly. So the derivative with respect to beta of J recovers those fluxes. And so you see there's a lot of beautiful structure here. That is to say, the Euler equations generally have the form of a scalar function H star, which is nothing but the Legendre dual of the entropy, the gradient of that with respect to its variables. I think I killed it. Oh, well. Put this down. With respect to beta. And then this is not a scalar function. This is a d-dimensional vector function. But it also with respect to beta. And so this is the general structure you have for such a system. So it's not a general hyperbolic system you would see in the form of a classical PDE book. It's somehow more constraints than that. And the why do I say it's hyperbolic? Well, the hyperbolicity is actually quite obvious. If you just differentiate with respect to, take the time derivative through, by the chain rule, this is what the first term is, and this is what the second term is. So this is the Hessian matrix of second derivatives here and here. And as second derivatives are symmetric matrices, that's a symmetric matrices. In fact, this is, they're both symmetric matrices. This is even positive definite by the strict convexity of the H, or the H star. And so, if you're familiar with the theory of symmetric hyperbolic systems, this is therefore one of them. You just read it off. This observation about this structure was actually first made by Gudinov, that if you have this sort of potential structure, you automatically get hyperbolicity. And he also observed, the next thing, that if you now take this equation and dot it with the beta, multiply by beta, then what's outside the derivatives is itself a perfect derivative of beta, and you almost by inspection get another conservation law for free. And to realize what this is physically, you understand that this is essentially the formula for the Legendre dual of H star, which means this is little h, and so we understand this is nothing but the entropy, the physical entropy for the fluid dynamic equations. Claude, yeah? That's coming. Yeah. Not quite. So what Friedrich, yeah, this is a story you should know because it was very controversial at the time. So if I now re-express things in terms of rho, then the flux always has this very nice form. In other words, anything that has an entropy, physical entropy, must have this particular form. The flux is not some arbitrary function whose derivatives have real distinct eigenvalues or anything like that, like you see in many textbooks. This is actually the right way. It's more restrictive than that in some sense. So just these. So if you're given a conservation law and you're given an entropy, the only freedom you have is these scalars J, or J star, in selecting a system that has an entropy. And the entropy is simply this, where the J is somehow, this is not a Legendre dual relation, but given the J star, this is just a formula for the J. So J is not the Legendre dual of J star. J star is actually a vector valued object, it's not convex. This is just an algebraic formula. Okay, and indeed, these can be derived any number of ways. For instance, you just set our explicit formula for the equilibrium into the conservation laws or the dissipation law, and you would get either this or this. This is what you get, but the structure is absent when you do that. This shows you particularly the structure these equations have. Now, this observation, that this system has an entropy, and is therefore symmetric hyperbolic, Friedrichs and Lax wrote a very famous paper, after Gudinov's paper, in which they observed that if you have a physical entropy, you automatically get hyperbolicity. Now, everyone understood this was connected with Gudinov's earlier paper, but it wasn't understood till a few years later when Mach showed that the two notions were the same. That is to say, the physical entropy, if you have a physical entropy, you have a recipe for the Gudinov potential form. Now, one could argue, why didn't Gudinov see that? The answer is clearly no, because if you read many papers Gudinov wrote between the time his first paper appeared and the Lax-Friedrichs paper appeared, in fact, and the Mach paper appeared much later, Gudinov took systems that had perfectly good physical entropies, and instead of using the dual relation to say the job is done, he actually laboriously, by hand, you know, worked these things out. So it's clear that Mach was really the first one to understand this whole picture. And this is a very general and beautiful setting. If you don't know this, even if you don't work in kinetic theory, you should know this if you have anything to do with hyperbolic systems. Moreover, and maybe I'll just skip over this a little bit, but because of the hyperbolicity, you can actually characterize with a Riley quotient, the different eigenvalues of the system. You can show, for instance, for discrete velocity models, that these interlace with the eigenvalues of the discrete velocity model, for example. So that's a remark for the talk. And so now I've given you this abstract notion. I've talked about the Euler equations associated with it. And this is not, this went by a little fast, maybe, but what I'm trying to deliver is this message that the Boltzmann equation is more than just an equation of gas dynamics, but it is really the grandfather of all kinetic equations, and many aspects of the structure of the Boltzmann equation really convey to all these kinetic equations. Okay. So, Francois wrote down a very particular form of the Boltzmann equation yesterday, where he gave a formula for this B, which is the hard sphere formula, formula for hard spheres. More generally, Maxwell himself gave a more general recipe for the collision operator. It's important to realize, historically, that Boltzmann did not invent the Boltzmann equation. Maxwell invented the Boltzmann equation, although he didn't write it the way Boltzmann and we think of it now. He wrote it in a slightly different way. But if you read Boltzmann's original paper, not his book, his book doesn't make it so clear. You read Boltzmann's original paper, it's quite clear. He says, I got this from Maxwell. And so one should understand that it's Maxwell who came up with the notion of the differential cross-section. And here is, so the B can be written as this relative velocity of the two particles. I recall for you Francois' diagrams from yesterday. And something which has been dubbed in the physics literature the differential cross-section. What the form of this is depends on how you choose to parameterize the collision. It's differential with respect to your choice of parameters of the collision. In classical kinetic books, they'll use the impact parameter, for example. But you're not restricted to the impact parameter. Any choice of parameterization of the collision, you can consider the differential cross-section with respect to that. So, you consider a unit vector. This thing depends only on this cosine here and the relative speed of the two molecules coming. So there's a recipe for computing these things for a given force law. And I'll just comment what that looks like just to contrast it with yesterday's lecture. It to really describe how this comes about would take a lecture in itself. I don't want to do that. But I'll suffice it to say that if you have a very simple repulsive potential that's a power law, like so, then you can show that this differential cross-section has a nice factorized form where you get the speed, the relative speed, raised to a power beta, which is less than 1. And in fact, D remembers the dimension of the space, so depending on what k is, this can go negative. And this will be locally integrable, provided the singularity that's there doesn't go worse than minus d. And that leads to this inequality here. So in particular, in d equals 3, this crossover case, the marginal case, corresponds to the Coulomb potential. So what this means is really the Coulomb potential as a source of a cross-section doesn't make sense in a Boltzmann collision kernel. And this is the reason, of course, that we had the discussions yesterday about the Fokker-Planck kind of collision terms. And those can be derived for Coulomb interactions. I should remark that this beta leads to a certain terminology. When the beta is positive, there's no singularity in this, or beta zero, no singularity in this. And this is called the hard potentials, the hard potential case. That because when beta is 1, this is the hard sphere formula that Francois gave last time. So as those are the hard potentials, when beta is negative, we call them soft potentials. And then we have some integrable singularity here. But the nature of the singularity, as long as we satisfy this, it's still going to be an integrable singularity, but it leads to analytical difficulties that really must be dealt with. So when you read papers in kinetic theory, they'll talk about the hard case or the soft case. This is all they're talking about. Yeah?
But D equal 2, understanding that
Yes.
It's not what you get here.
Exactly. And any other D does it correspond to that? It's only D equals 3 that cut off this naturally, the sort of the Poisson, the kernel of the Poisson operator. Yeah. Yeah, I'm getting you to this. This guy, that's on the next slide. You also want it to be locally integrable with respect to omega. And it's well-behaved. It's wonderful, except there's a nasty singularity. And the nature of the singularity is, well, O is an exponent bigger than 1. D can't be 1 in kinetic theory. So D is always 2 or more. So it's strictly bigger than 1. And this is really bad from the point of view of understanding the collision operator in terms of a gain and loss term separately. In fact, it really means it can't be done. So as that was very much the subject of the way, so the first person to sort of seriously mathematically look at the business of kinetic theory was Hilbert. And Hilbert was very puzzled by this. These singularities in omega. And so he, in the end, only treated the hard sphere case that Francois treated last time, because this case has no singularity in omega, in this B hat. And much later, it was understood by Harold Grad that you could do cutoffs and sort of replicate Hilbert's proofs. And that's what I'm referring to here. So we talk about so-called cutoff collision kernels introduced, which replaces the nasty B above with some more benign one. There's many recipes for this. I won't discuss them here, but this introduces the terminology of cutoff kernels, non-cutoff kernels. It has to do with killing the singularity. Recently, there has been good progress made on the non-cutoff case, but not when, for the infinite media problem, I should say, is where the most case has been made. All right, so with that discussion of the Boltzmann kernel, that whole class of cutoff kernels, both hard and soft, more or less satisfy the abstract structure I gave in the beginning of the talk, and therefore have nice Euler equations and formally at least have this similar Euler limits. Let me now find other examples. First, there's a whole class, which I'll give a few examples of Boltzmann-like kinetic theories, like in the sense that they have the same entropy and the same set of local conservation laws. What that means is they'll have the same equilibria, always, Maxwellians. And the most famous of those, perhaps, is what's commonly called BBGK model, BGK model, no, not BB, 1B, BGK model. Other people actually have introduced this relaxation model as well, so you'll see other letters used in some of the literature, but by far BGK is the most common annotation used. I think it's very dangerous if one thinks that naming should be a sign of attribution of origin. This is never the case. It usually is an attribution of some significant contribution, and I'm willing, since names really have to do with labeling things and communication, I just never read in origin of the idea into that, and I think this is a good example, as the fact the Boltzmann equation wasn't really origined with Boltzmann, but clearly he came up with the entropy and stuff like that. So I don't, unlike some strange characters in the past, I will not advocate changing the name of the Boltzmann equation to the Maxwell equation. Maxwell has enough. All right, so here's the thing, and it's a simple relaxation model discussed before. Depends. The Galilean invariance means it only depends on rho and theta. Here's our Maxwellian and subtracting the F in this way. This is a quick and dirty thing you can always do. Now, I mentioned what happens when you have a soft Coulomb-type potential in three dimensions. What's going on there is you're getting a lot of small-angle deflections because the 1 over r is decaying so slow, there's a lot of very small collisions, small deflection collisions happening. And you can do a different kind of scaling on the problem in that case. And then you can actually get this Fokker-Planck-Landau form of a collision operator, which is a second order in velocity derivative thing, but you have these coefficients which are non-local in velocity. There's integrals here. This depends on the v. This is the same notation as before, so this f depends on v star, and we're deriving with respect to v star. Okay? And you again have a freedom in a kind of kernel here. So one can check this satisfies all the properties. Now, let's go to a more general setting. In the general setting I laid out, you can always have a collision operator which satisfies the hypotheses. Merely use a relaxation collision operator like so. This will always satisfy the various properties that I laid out. So there's no issue of realizability here in this abstract setting. You always have at least one example, and usually many more. So you just replace the Maxwellian with the equilibrium and replace the relaxation time with some more general thing there. And you can check this satisfies the properties there. Now, why do this abstraction? Well, there's things in physics that aren't classical particles, for example. And in this case, you may have Fermi, Dirac, or Bose-Einstein statistics for when you're in quantum regimes. In that case, the entropy changes. Here's the Fermi-Dirac case. Here's the Bose-Einstein case. And you can easily compute the associated Legendre duals. In this case, it's something you can do analytically. Don't believe that's always the case that you can do it analytically, but in this case you can. And then you get these very famous equilibria. This is called the Fermi-Dirac equilibria, and this is the Bose-Einstein equilibria. So for those of you that have physics training, this is not a surprise. For those of you that maybe have had math training, maybe you haven't seen this before, but there is something out there. There's reasons to consider these general settings. Got a little bit rambunctious here. Ran over the side. So the associated collision operator, so the analog of binary collisions, actually gets quite a bit more complicated. And the reason is that you have to understand two things about, you have to understand that Fermi-Dirac particles obey something called an exclusion principle. Basically, they don't like each other. No two of them will occupy the same microstate at the same instant and time. So they tend to exclude. So you see, if we interpret, now let's interpret the loss term here. Remember, this product in the classical collision operator corresponds to particles with speed v at v prime, say, coming in, and producing particles with speed v star prime and, I mean, v and v star, producing particles with speed v prime and v star prime. Now, the point is that you can't produce those particles if there's already something in that state. So you have these little switches here that turn off those collisions if those states are occupied. Now, there's some bit funny business in the normalization here. For instance, this clearly has something to do with the dimensions of F. The fact there's a 1 here must be special. And what's special here is I've chosen this measure to be exactly this here, which is motivated by the uncertainty principle, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which identifies a volume of phase space, a unit volume, a unit state in phase spaces corresponding to this differential volume. And so all your measures are done with respect to that differential measure, and that's here. And that is why I have a 1 here. Otherwise, if I used any other here, there would be some scale factor here that would be less fortunate. So these switches turn things off in the case of Fermi-Dirac. For the case of Bose-Einstein, it's the opposite. Everyone likes a party. So the particles tend to all group together. This is why we have lasers. That is to say, in a laser, the photons, which are bosons par excellence, really are all hankering to get into the same state. Thus, everything is just chugging along together like so. So the effect there is that it really likes being in the enhanced state. So I'll discuss it in terms of the loss term. So because I'd be adding a particle to this state rather than turning on, it actually sort of enhances or stimulates collisions into the new states. And that's the meaning of these additional terms. It's really non-trivial to check. I mean, it's a little, it's not, it's elementary, but non-trivial in the sense that you have to group terms in a semi-intelligent way to see that these things have the equilibria that I wrote down before and satisfy all the properties in the abstract setting I wrote down before. Okay, so I want to close now with something which is a step toward much more complicated equations of state. Now, there are two ways. So far, every equation of state I've discussed would be some version of ideal or perfect guess, whichever you prefer to call it. And with a very particular kind of perfect guess. And what I'd like to do is show how to go more general to get actually any perfect gas or any ideal gas out of a kinetic equation. And this is a step on the way to adding more complicated equation of states. So for example, in plasmas, if you have to deal with partial ionization, partially ionized plasma in a kinetic formulation, you can do it relatively painlessly in this kind of framework. So I'll show this kind of framework. So now what we do is the state will be determined by not only the velocity of the molecule, but the energy of the internal energy of the molecule. I should say the energy of all the internal modes of the molecule. So, for instance, rotational and vibrational modes. And I could let F now be a function of these guys. The measure now has a weight here, and I'll show you how that weight can be computed from the microscopic physics in just a second. And now, given the microscopic states, the energy is the kinetic energy plus the internal energy, like so. All right, now the kinetic equation formally looks the same, except now things are a function of more variables, and I don't even have to get into the guts of this collision operator to discuss what the local equilibria are, or anything like this, as I showed you before. So I'm going to do that. I just point out that if I use the classical sort of case, I have momentum and energy conserved as well as number of particles. And let me discuss the F log F case, the classical statistical case. Okay, so how do you get this J and where does this come from? Well, I can take a quantum mechanical approach or you can take a classical approach. In fact, most of kinetic theory can be done from the point of view of classical mechanics. And I'll do that here just because it's accessible to more people. However, you can also take a quantum approach to this without any, if you know quantum mechanics, without too much more pain. So what I'm going to assume is that an isolated molecule is itself a Hamiltonian system, maybe a dumbbell that's rotating or a more complicated object. Perhaps you can imagine the legs of it being springs that allow vibrations. And as long, when it's not interacting with anything else, it itself is a Hamiltonian system like this. So H is a single molecule Hamiltonian. Okay. Now, given any quantity G, given Hamiltonian dynamics, you know that the evolution of G is given by the Poisson bracket of G with H, which Poisson bracket being defined like so. So for those of you that have some knowledge of Hamiltonian mechanics, this should look familiar. For those of you that don't, I encourage you to learn. And now let's look at the center of mass. Assume that the center of mass is given by some function of the configuration particles. So this is very simple. If you have a multi-atomic molecule, maybe with three here, you just compute the center of mass in the classical way, and it's a function of the configuration of the three molecules, three atoms, say. And now the velocity of that, being the time derivative of that, is given as a function of P and Q by the Poisson bracket with H. All right? And this corresponds to this is more or less the momentum. Times the mass, it's the momentum. The mass isn't changing. So it's conserved by the flow. This is a non-interacting atom. It's just going along, a molecule, I mean. And so this V is actually commutes, Poisson commutes with H. Okay, now the Hamiltonian is given by this kinetic energy, this is the kinetic energy plus the internal energy. Let's decompose it that way. And because this V is conserved quantity, it's a vector valued conserved quantity, and this is conserved, this internal energy is also conserved by the dynamics. Okay. Now, how do you get this mysterious J? The way you get the mysterious J is nothing but integrating over the whole phase space for your atom of restricting yourself so that the E has the values of the internal energy. Actually, it's, I call it specific internal energy because you're always dividing by the M. The I is specific, but or we can call MI the internal energy. So you let this be have value I. This is a function of P and Q. This is a function of P and Q, which you set equal to V, and this like so. Now, it's sort of odd here. This should be a function of E, V, and X. However, if this the dynamics on the other side is Galilean invariant, which I'm assuming, it's very easy to apply the various actions of the Galilean group to see that this quantity can only depend on E. So you can, in particular, you get its value by computing it for molecules that are just stationary, or say, said another way, move yourself into the frame of the molecule. Okay. So this, the J, therefore, is something you can, if, once you have a simple model for your molecule, you can always compute this J, in principle. And now, given the J, you can write down the equilibrium. The equilibrium are going to be linear combinations of V and the E and 1 in the logarithm, you know, E to the linear combinations. But you can give it a more enlightened form if you write it this way. It looks a lot like, notice I'm using the Maxwellian notation again, but now I have a, this would be 1 in the classical Maxwellian, and that E wouldn't be there. And you see that this function Z, which should look a little bit like a partition function, suggesting of a partition function for those that know statistical mechanics, is nothing but a kind of transform, kind of Laplace transform of the J. So the J you get from the microscopic physics, you do this kind of Laplace transform and you get yourself the Z, and the Z, all good things follow from the Z, all right? And this just gives how one, and the main thing is you get this internal energy coming out of the Z is nothing but the derivative with respect to theta of the log of the Z times theta squared. Just a remark. This is just repeating the formula from the last slide. The last term you interpret, and if you look back at what that is, it's nothing but the average specific energy of all the internal modes, and it is an increasing function of theta, as it should be. All right, so for this model, you now have Euler equations, which I've written out. You see you get the pressure is still rho times theta, the traditional ideal gas law, but you really can more or less specify an arbitrary internal energy that makes thermodynamic sense, some sort of increasing function of theta. So in particular, you can therefore empirically match, you can always derive kinetic equations that match any ideal gas equation of state. You can work this process backwards, and people do, to actually come up with toy kinetic equations for numerical simulation that give the same fluid dynamics. Well, no, it's for gases, rarefied gases, two-body collisions is probably okay. I haven't discussed how I'm modeling the collisions. It's toy because, of course, the actual rendition of the molecule doesn't have to be so faithful as to include all of the degrees of freedom the molecule may have. For instance, you may not need the vibrational modes in some cases. For instance, we know that. Well, that's the remark on the next view graph. Ideal gas law, if you open your basic thermodynamics book, ideal gases have two properties, but basically the internal energy is a function of theta only, increasing function of theta only, and that PV equals nRT. And so in particular, by choosing this very simple J, which says nothing about the microscopic physics, you can recover the typical polytropic gas law fitting the traditional gamma. This is the so-called gamma of polytropic gases. You can back out the alpha this way, boop, boop, like so. So for a dumbbell diatomic molecule, this is the gamma you would have in d dimensions. So when d is 3, this is the 7/5 gamma. And you can model that with this kind of J and these kind of molecules. Okay, so that's pretty much what I wanted to cover today, just to show you, in some sense, the versatility of what was covered in the first lecture. It actually has lots of other applicabilities, and the general structure is something you should understand. This actually allows a lot of what goes on in fluid dynamics formally to be carried over to all of these kinetic equations. In particular, Navier-Stokes we'll talk about in the next hour. And with this, I'll stop and we'll take a 5-minute break while Francois sets up. Thank you. Questions? Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, questions. Jeremy. Yeah. Well, I just wrote them down, right?
You know that those are all equilibria.
Yes.
So you talk with this question, but all the equilibria are those.
Well, for that, I would have to write down a collision operator that explicitly has these. I could do that, of course, by my observation that I could always do the BGK, generalized BGK collision operator to model this. So that's, but what people tend to do is try and construct more realistic operators. They'll talk about spheres that collide and have some sort of a slip condition, and it can get very complicated and ugly. There's no reason to construct such complicated operators if you can use something more simple like BGK and generalizations of BGK that actually recover the correct transport coefficients, which is the subject of the future lectures. Yes. Yes. No, it's worse than that. So, yeah, you don't have Galilean symmetry in a cellular, if you do lattice gases in a fully compressible regime. You don't have this very simple momentum flux, for example, where things are proportional to U tensor U. Rather, that gets coupled by a 4 tensor, which isn't isotropic. So you get all kinds of things. Yeah, Jeremy, you've done lots of lattice calculations, but these are not pretty.
And
you can, but you may not find them on a lattice. You may need to go to a continuum model. Yeah. Any other questions? Which one, the Boltzmann one, or any?
Any, in general form. What I mean is, look at the differential operator.
Yeah. Right.
But to me, the equation operator is something.
It's a mystery, yeah. Well, I view the collision operator as just a recipe which tells you how things are organizing itself in phase space, how the distribution is reorganizing itself in phase space. So, for example, in terms of recovering macroscopic dynamics, something as mindless as a BGK, which is a simple relaxation operator and clearly has not much to do with the microscopic dynamics other than getting the conservation laws right, seems to work pretty well. And people use it in kinetic simulations. Or modifications of it. So the Boltzmann collision operator, Maxwell was really trying to mimic what he felt were the dominant microscopic physics, and it works pretty well. And what's interesting is it works pretty well even as you push into dense regimes where you know more and more triple collisions are happening. You could say in part because it's getting the basic conservation laws right. So I think it's really it's part of this discussion we were having yesterday is how is the distribution organizing itself into some lower dimensional thing? Is that, that's the general way I view it. Francois, you have some comment?
Yeah, but I think in the case of Haas here, that's the physical explanation.
Right. It's the mechanistic view of it. That's too cheap. Yeah, no, I mean to me the if you have a real collisional operator, I mean these entropy structures are clearly much more important than anything else, the conservation entropy structures. They determine not only the exact form of the Euler system, but that plus just a little bit more gives you Navier-Stokes. You know, the details of these operators really doesn't you know, you can get the microphysics quite wrong and still have the macrophysics correct. And this is something important to understand. So it's just a question of what the mixing is that's going on. And you may get the mechanism of the mixing wrong in detail and still have the global picture right. So this is at least my view of the game. That's, yes. Right. Right, but what's really important is to understand what class of operators lead to the same kind of behaviors on different levels. And yeah, but it's actually probably the more important issue that has to be focused. For instance, if you're modeling something with a Liouville equation, you're making some choice about the microscopic physics already, like a classical description when these are quantum objects, you know. Yeah. Yeah. Any other question? All right. Break.
Okay, then 5 minute break. Time to set up.